I'm going to introduce you to three gentlemen who once were ugly. And they're going to tell you how they became beautiful. Allow me to introduce to you my good friend from Massachusetts, John H.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is John. I was born on Mission Hill, baptized in a mission church, so I'm Boston Irish. And that probably doesn't mean a hell of a lot to you, but it does mean something to me. I worked with, at the beginning of my career in Alcoholics Anonymous, I worked with a lot of newcomers. And newcomers always reminded me, I had this relative in Ireland, and they were too prosperous over there. And he bought a car, and he's running down the road with the car with the wife, and all of a sudden this police officer is mentioning him to the side of the road. So he pulls over and he says, "Can I help you, officer?" And the officer says, he says, "I'm sorry to tell you, sir," he says, "but your wife popped out of the car about 3 miles back." And he says, "Thank the Lord." He says, "I thought I was going deaf." A lot of new alcoholics are deaf. So was I when I got here, okay? I went to high school, and I know that you understand that I was probably a very good student. I'm like probably the only one in eastern Massachusetts. I have two high school reunions to go to. The class I should have graduated with and the one I did. And you understand that I was not a disciplinary problem either. And I think they gave me 80 hours of disciplinary. I had to come back to high school, in other words, and do this 80 hours. And they thought, oh, he'll never do it. But I did it. And the only reason I did it is I was playing varsity hockey and I wanted to play. So I went back. But then I had to go to prep school. And then I was accepted to a couple of universities around the Boston area. And my father told me there was one Ivy League school I was not going to. He says, "They're all full of communists there." Anyway, yeah, you can probably understand which one it was. My father had strong views. Now, my father was an alcoholic, but they didn't call him in those days. They met in Boston, obviously, and because I was born there, that's why. And my mother got my drinking father the hell out of there and out to Bedford, which is a town about 22 miles away from Boston, but my Irish relatives in Boston thought that was about 3 miles this side of Montana. And they didn't drink out there. And my father stopped drinking in 1930. And there was, some people say it was simultaneous with my birth, but that's just an unfounded rumor. And after high school, I went to college. But in high school, I picked up a drink, but I was a periodic. I could pick it up and put it down. And then that went on through my high school career, went on through the military, and went on through, now I'm, I always knew what I wanted to be. There was no doubt in my mind what I was going to be. I went to law school nights. I was married by that time. I had six children. I had obviously a wife. I was drinking, and she was doing something. And I don't know what the hell she was doing. But the greatest regret of my life, and the thing I'm most ashamed of, is I was a father. But as some of us know, I wasn't a father. I was never there. I was somewhat like my father, but my father was sober. I wasn't. And I had a beach place. I used to see the mothers and fathers walking their children to the beach, and I couldn't do that. I'm on the porch because drinking was just too important. That's the thing I'm most ashamed of and most humiliated by. The main part of my story and the main part of my life is because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, somebody said to me one time, he said, "Jesus," he said, "how come you never were arrested?" I said, "It's very difficult to get arrested when you're drinking with the cops." And I was drinking with him. And finally one day, this police officer, and you'll understand the story, I mean, he was on the night shift, and he got in the morning, and this guy was talking to some beautiful young lady at the end of the bar. And this guy wasn't paying any attention. My guy wanted to drink, and he, trying to get his attention. And she just took out a .38 and fired a couple of rounds. got his attention. Chief had a dim view, brought him up on charges, and I'm there, and of course the guy came into my life, and because this guy said, well, there's a guy coming from the Boston Police Stress Program, and he arrived. And he said to me, your client's a drunk. I said, no kidding. I drink with him. He falls down a lot. He says, well, he's an alcoholic. I say, I know that. I said, you just said that. And he says, well, do you know anything about alcoholism? And I says, why should I? He says, well, aren't you representing him? I said, yeah. He says, well, for Christ's sake, you know, you should know something about alcoholism. So he started talking to me about alcoholism. He started to talk to me about the things that were on the fifth stool down at the Elks Club or the Marine Corps League or the, you know, the VFW or the Legion. You know the war stories that go on there. He's talking to me about loneliness, and he's talking to me about fear, and he's talking to me about shame and humiliation, and he's talking to me that about a lot of us, you know, we don't know how to be parents, we don't know how to parent children, we don't know how to love. And this guy was getting my attention. Physically, I was stepping away from him. And there was another guy there, not a police officer, who I knew was going to AA because I heard the judge tell him, you're going to that AAA. So I leaned over to this guy and I said, you still go to that AAA? He says, I'll pick you up at 6:45. Now, of course, by this time, I was living alone in my little high-rise apartment. Matter of fact, there was a shooting at one of the clubs. And you know how they paid me because they couldn't pay me in coin of the realm? Do you think they knew me pretty well? You know what they sent over to me? A case of scotch. Jesus, I stopped drinking with a case of scotch. Imagine that. I sometimes have trouble imagining that. Oh, I want to tell you, one of that friends of mine had one of those near-death experiences, and he came back, and I said, geez, how was the experience? He said, well, it's good news, bad news. And I says, well, what's the bad news? And he says, well, somebody was praying for me very violently, and they brought me back. I said, I says, well, what's the good news? He says, gee, he says, up there, he says, they were having a party. You know what they were serving? I says, what? He says, Johnny Walker Red. When I walked into my first meeting, everybody knew who I was going to meet. It was going to meet Joe. He was a retired lawyer from New York City. So lawyers have always been in my life, thank God. And it was, I was the first designated driver you ever heard about. And Joe didn't have a license, so I couldn't drive or something. And I figured, well, maybe it was an OUI or something. God, I was something else. And, you know, the best conversations were the ones going to and from the meeting. Because I couldn't divulge myself and any of my problems in front of you, God forbid. So I would tell, you know, Joe all of these things that, Jesus, Joe, when I have dreams, Joe, I have dreams in Technicolor. Years later, he said, you remember that you told me about the Technicolor? I said, yeah. He says, the DTs. I said, yeah, I figured it out. But a man of my stature couldn't be in the DTs, right? So then I said, Joe, what the hell are these people talking about? Character defects. And he says, well, he says, if you don't know what they are, he says, go back and ask the people that you live with. I says, I'm living alone. He says, that's the first clue. Barbara asked Joe, how did Higgins ever get sober? And Joe said, he just kept coming. And you know something? I just kept coming. That's the absolute truth. I just kept coming. You know what I wanted to hear was, I wanted you to tell me how to live, because I didn't know how to live. I know how to make a living. I knew how to do that. But I didn't know how to live, and you people taught me that. You people taught me how to live, what love was all about. You know, he said to me, you know, there's a book called the Bible. Is the Catholic college graduate familiar with it? And I says, I am, Joe. And he says, well, he says, there's a certain passage of that book you want to refresh your memory with. Now, in 78, just as I met Nancy, my lovely wife, and incidentally, the woman who's going to interrupt me is probably going to be my wife. I'm second banana in my house. I've only got 30 years sober. Nancy's 35 and Eleanor. Oh, yeah, you're supposed to say your sobriety date, February 28, 1975. See, I've said it. Around my way, we don't do that. Anyway, I was working as a trial attorney at the district court level, and Joe said to me, you know, you can be a lot of help to a lot of people. And me and the judge had a little deal going, and I would say to these people, you know, you got 20 seconds to make your mind up whether you're going to go with me to AA or whether you're going to go to jail. You only got 5 seconds now. So I came across a lot of those new people. And I walked into a meeting. As a matter of fact, two of the people at my first meeting are seated in this hall this afternoon. Then my sponsor said, you know, there's a group of lawyers that, and he said this in 1976. He says, you know, there's a group of lawyers meeting in Toronto. And it was like my DI at Quantico. He said, go. I said, yes, and went. And I met a lot of wonderful people, a lot of wonderful people who continued to explain to me what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. A couple of them seated at this table, more than a couple are seated in the audience. And, you know, I'm a learner, but maybe a slow learner, but I learned how to live. And everything in my life has been learned in Alcoholics Anonymous because I really didn't know how to live. I used to walk down my beach place and look up into a star-filled sky on a beautiful summer night and wonder, what in the hell is the matter with me? Now, isn't it the irony of ironies that I came to a room full of drunks and found out how to live? That still amuses me. Huh? And because I didn't know how to live. You know, in 1978, a lot of things happened. My ex-wife called me one night, and I had just met Nancy. And she said, your son Thomas was just killed in a motor vehicle accident, and the Maine State Police want to talk to you. And she said, your other son, Michael, I have four sons, was in the death car, but he switched positions, and you have to call the Maine State Police, because Michael is a basket case. So I called the Maine State Police, and the kid driving the car, he was dead, too. And I had to help make arrangements, because the other lady was a widow, and she was somewhat devastated by this. So we arranged two funerals, and on Saturday, I think, my son Thomas was buried. Now, in the meantime, Nancy had come down with two little kids, seven and eight, her two kids. I had six, she had two. And they had a dog, and the dog ran out in the street and got killed. So then I flew in another dog, and that dog would try to get through a little gate and strangled itself. That dog died. And we flew in the third dog. And then I'm at that funeral on Saturday, and I got another call from the Maine State Police because a woman who was my son Michael's fiancée was found murdered in the field. And we had to get the whole family back together again and go to another funeral in Maine. And my Uncle John died. There was a whole bunch of death. And a Jesuit came to me and he said to me, he says, you know, you're a very lucky man. And I said, I didn't think I was, Father. And he says, well, you've had to study death. And if you can't study death, then maybe you don't know how to live. But a very valuable lesson. And my sponsor told me, you know, there's a book in that called the Bible. He says, it's about Job. And I says, well, I'm not angry with God. I says, I never have been. I says, and Job said to me, well, when you first came into this program, you were that type that weren't angry with God, but you were indifferent. That was worse. And I had to, you know, kind of look at what Joe was always telling me. Now, I want to share with you the most important words that were ever said to me in my life by anybody under any circumstances, and it was said by Joe. You know, I wasn't interested in your story when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't even interested in mine. I just wanted to know. I just wanted to get what you had. That's what I wanted. And I wanted to get there damn quick. No fooling around. Give me a bottom line stuff. Joe said, look at you, a drunk. Get on your knees in the morning and ask a higher power to keep you a drunk away from a drink for a day. Can you do that, says he? I can, says I. Do it, says he. At the end of the day, he says, you get back on your knees and you thank that same power that kept you a drunk away from a drink. Can you do that, says he? I can, says I. Do it, says he. A couple of days later, he says, Joe said, are you saying you're asking a higher power to keep you a drunk away from a drink? I says, I'm doing that while I'm in the shower. He says, you don't listen very well. He says, I said, get on your knees. And that's what I tell my people. Get on your knees. Get on your knees and ask that power, because that power can do anything for you. Now, incidentally, Nancy and I got married in 1978. What do we have? We had all the statistics in the world tell you that a marriage like this can't exist. You know, my five, her two, let's see, she brought into the marriage, let's see, a cat, a dog, and a canary. But the cat scared the hell out of the canary, and the canary had a heart attack and died. Those two little geniuses. You know, so I had another opportunity to be a father. Imagine that. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous does. It teaches us and lets us have another opportunity. Another opportunity to accomplish what we really wanted to accomplish. And you've got to give me that two-minute warning, right? Okay. And Mother of God, everything that I've ever Remember when you were a little kid and you thought of what you wanted to do with your life? I've done it. I absolutely have. I have absolutely no regrets whatsoever. And I always have to remember that my day starts on my knees with a prayer, as it did this morning, and it will if I'm alive tomorrow morning. But it always starts there. Now, and Nancy and I got married, and like I told you, she's a long time now. And going back to, I'm on the board of a couple of halfway houses. I'm the token drunk in a lot of places. All the judges know me. I successfully tried a capital case in front of the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts. So I've even done that. So now I'm kind of devoting my life to being a strong and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to reach out to people. You know, some of the people that I reach out to, jail-bound, and we've had some success with some of these people. I know one guy, Jackie, the judge was a great guy. God love me, retired. Called me down one Friday afternoon, and the prosecutor, who's a friend of mine, said, well, he says, you know, we didn't have a town drunk, but this guy moved in. We have one. First thing you have to do is get around the smell. And I just looked at him, and I said, you know, I go to AA meetings every single night in the week. I said, if you want to be in front of my house, I'll take you to a meeting, but don't do me any favors. And never thinking that this guy would come. And he's about 25 years sober today. So every time I think that somebody can't make it, you know, the guy upstairs shows me that there isn't anybody, anywhere that can't make this program, whatever circumstances they may find themselves in. And sometimes I hobnob, with a guy that can't rub two dimes together and a guy that's a multimillionaire. And you know what the problem is? The problem is the same. You know, I remember a woman gushingly coming up to me and saying, oh, John, you represent this fellow. He's an MD, a PhD, he's a full professor at a very famous medical institution. He just made some breakthrough in the field of diabetes. He lectures all over the world, and I says, oh, yeah, he's a great guy, but he's got one teensy-weensy little problem. And she says, what might that be? And I says, well, he can't stop drinking. But he was just like me. You know, he's a periodic. You can put it down and pick it up. I don't know how much more I can say, but I've got to leave Mr. Campbell some time. But, somebody else wrote this, and I plagiarized, because this is what my life today is all about. Of all the things I have done in my profession, it is the work with alcoholics that I am most proud of and which has given me the most satisfaction. And that's the truth. I am sober today only because of it, and have been repaid many times over and over for any effort I put toward this cause. I am grateful that I have been given this opportunity to work with a great team of people who are either recovering or who have been affected by someone else's alcoholism. None of us stand alone. We need to be reminded from time to time that we must put aside our selfish and petty concerns for the benefit of the still suffering, addicted person. We are reminded by Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob that we must work with our friends and that we have no personal interest that is more important than the work that we do. We save lives. If we have conflicts with groups or agencies or individuals who are also dedicated to our work, then we must first look to ourselves and see where we have been wrong and make errors, and we must be tolerant of others or we will die. The lives of future generations of addicted persons depend upon our ability to work together. If we do not, the penalty will fall on them. We owe a debt to those who have gone before. We can repay that debt and ensure our safety by clearing away the wreckage of the past and by helping others into the fellowship of the Spirit. Thank you.
Thank you, John. One of the privileges of chairing is that I get to identify briefly with the previous speaker, and I can also critique. So, I remember when I was struggling with being a lawyer, an alcoholic, and I didn't understand that I was an alcoholic who happened to be a lawyer. But I thought I was the only one. I would ask you all, please, look at this room, turn around and see how full it is. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I don't feel so alone. I, like John, was a periodic. And I could stop drinking, but I couldn't stay stopped. But I could stop. And so I didn't need AA as much as the daily drinker. Until someone told me, Eli, periodics, daily drinkers should go to a meeting every day. Periodics need two a day at minimum. And that was true in my case. I also want to add one other thing that I did recently. My children, my boys, were 4 and 6 years old when I stopped drinking. And 2 years ago, my eldest son delivered a granddaughter and then delivered another one about 2 months ago. And I realized with a two-year-old how much I had missed with my children. Totally. And here, just over Christmas, I had an opportunity to sit down with my sons together and individually and make my amends that I was not there as a father for them because I had learned the joys of being a grandfather. Thank you for that as well. Next, John from, is it Ottawa or Ontario, John?
Toronto.
Toronto, okay. It said O-N-T.
I am an alcoholic, and my name is John. And I'm glad to see the room is full. I was warned that there would only be 7 people here, the ones I had paid. You are right. Lawyers are different. They have much, much, much more closed minds than anybody else. And they are bad of hearing. And they're slow learners. And as far as I know, until I was in AA for about a year or so, I had never met an alcoholic lawyer. I didn't think there were any. I thought there were just a bunch of good guys who drank occasionally. I drank occasionally. I was a periodic drinker, a steady drinker in between the periods. I don't see anything funny about that. Nor did my ex-wife. But then she chose not to go to Al-Anon. Otherwise, perhaps her sense of humor might have been improved a bit. I don't want to take you through years of qualification, but I do want to tell you a couple of things. Eli mentioned his father. I'd like to mention my grandfather, my father's father. Now, my father, as far as I remember, would have a drink of rye and water 3 times a year and not finish it. And he was a very controlled guy. And I often wondered why he was so controlled. But let me tell you a little bit about his father. And now, I don't know about alcoholism being hereditary or any of that stuff. But you listen to this story, and then I will tell you that I had 2 brothers who are now deceased, who were in this program from time to time. And one of them, a third brother, who by his own admission was not an alcoholic, he was a workaholic, but he smelled funny and had a bad sense of balance and a funny memory, even in the mornings. So I don't know what his problem was, but he told me he was not an alcoholic. But the grandfather, now, obviously a very, very brilliant man, because back in those days, in the 19th century, at the age of 26, he was the city editor of the main Toronto newspaper. At the age of 29, he was the assistant city editor of the Hamilton, that's a small town to the west, of their secondary newspaper. At the age of 32, he was a reporter on the Welland Gazette. At the age of 35, he was the founder of the Wyerton Echo. Wyerton then had a population of about 116, 300 miles north. And in that town, I might say that the newspaper still survives, but in that town, he had a distinction that was reported in his own newspaper, of driving a team of horses out of the barn without opening the doors. It is my understanding that this disease is caused by drinking, not by grandfathers. So I had to do my part, and I did. You could count on me. I don't want to take you into the time from 26 to 52. My age of 26 to 19, I was 52 years of age, but I went to my first bunch of AA meetings when I was 26 and 27. I probably went to 75 meetings in Toronto. I saw a lot of people I knew that deserved to be there. I knew how they drank. I drank with them. And I thought they needed to be there. But it was not for me. If I could have worn a surgical mask and gloves so as not to catch anything, I would have done so. They were a weird, weird bunch. Not my kind of people. 25 years later, they'd improved. I found, actually, that if I were to go to some meetings, one or two or three, during that next 25, 26 years, I could get the former Mrs. Campbell off my back. And so I would do that from time to time, and I'd get 20 minutes of peace. But as I said, she didn't go to Alamon, so. And that's a shame, because who knows what would have happened. The speculation didn't get you anywhere, but both her parents and my parents had a great friend who was sort of Mrs. Al-Anon in Toronto, and others that were close that were available. But people make their own choices, and so I have to respect that, and I do. I had the pleasure 10 days ago of being at my eldest granddaughter's graduation from high school with the former Mrs. Campbell, and there were no fistfights. The police were not called. I was gracious, as you would expect from me. But then that last time when I was 52, 50, 53, in that 33 years, up until that time, every once in a while, I would stop drinking. I stopped drinking for my usual time was 2 years at a time, just to show you. Didn't show me anything, but it was designed to show you. What it did show me was that arrogance was an asset. So I am a lawyer. And I don't know, things had spiraled down and down and down. And I'd stand in front of the mirror occasionally when I could get the bath towel off the mirror. I usually had a big bath towel hanging over it because I couldn't stand to look at me. I hated myself. And occasionally I'd look in there and I'd say, "You're no good. You're no damn good." I don't do that anymore. And I, at that time, was living in a house, rather attractive place. And I had one or two of my, I have three sons and two daughters. I had one or two of my sons living with me some of the time, theoretically. They couldn't stand me. The one wanted to go to university, so he ended up going to university in Montreal. And the other had a buddy whose father was apparently something like me, and the two of them shared a room downtown and occasionally would come up to the house. And frequently they would come for a meal, and they'd be in the house maybe 2-3 hours. They wouldn't even say pass the salt, say nothing. There was no communication. There was love, because they came, but they were disgusted with my conduct. And I didn't get the point. I missed it all. I grew up into this bedroom that I had, kind of an attractive room before I got it going. And I'd take the mirrors off the drawer, the best of the desk, or the chest of drawers, and slide them down behind so I couldn't see myself. And I had triple-line drapes and blinds and shutters and all closed up tightly so that on the brightest sunny day, not a pinpoint of light could get in, and I was afraid of the dark, so I had the lights on. I had a lock put on my door. I could have understood it if they'd had a lock put on the door. And I'd lie on the bed and plan my revenge. I'd get them. And I'd read a couple of lines, and I'd have to get up and go to the bathroom, and I had a little dressing room that had 5 cupboard doors that had mirrors on them, and I had to get those doors just so I could get by them without having to look at myself, because I hated myself. And I'd hold my head in that special spot in my pillow where I could hear the radio, which wasn't on. And I didn't see anything wrong. And the dog, I had a lovely dog lady. She came into the room and did a little Snoopy dance at the end of the bed and went back out, and there's nothing particularly, she was a real pain, she didn't drink. Nothing particularly strange about the way that she came in and went out, except that she came in through the closed door and went out through the closed door. And that got my attention. And I used to smoke a lot, so the rug bore a lot of stains from and burns. I had a smoking talent that very few of you weaklings would have had. I could smoke in the shower. Now, I know you could drink in the shower, but anybody could do that. I could smoke in the shower. John Higgins, since he broke my anonymity, I'll break his, wore his T-shirt yesterday. It says, "It's all about me." And I said, "You got that wrong. It's all about me." But, no, that's the way it was. And I remember one day, one of my son's friends called from downstairs, yelled and called and yelled and called, and I yelled back, and I back and forth this yelling. And finally, since he wasn't coming up, I had to get up, and I put on my dressing gown, which was the standard issue for us. It was the blue terry cloth model with the elbows out and the belt ragged and the 50 cigarette burns and the hardened vomit down the front. That's what I put on for good. And down I went. It was a big deal to go downstairs. Not so much going down, but getting back up was difficult. But downstairs, you know, there was different kind of... Upstairs, all there was scotch and slime and wet cigarette butt and an old chip peanut butter glass. Downstairs, there was fresh glasses and vodka and all, you know, stuff like that didn't smell and you could get away with it. Anyway, down I went. He was not there. Nobody was there. The place was empty. Nobody had been there. And I remember having previously said, if it ever gets that bad, I'll do something about it, whatever it was. And there it was that bad, and I wasn't doing anything about it. But it was a nice sunny day, and I went out in the garden, and I still have this mental picture of me in the garden with the dirty bare feet sticking out from under this stupid dressing gown, and the tousled hair and the unshaven face and the circles under my eyes, and it was dawn, and the sun was just coming up, and I looked at the sun coming up through the trees, and I shook my fist at it, and I said, "God damn you, God, for doing this to me." I'm not proud of having to tell you that, but that's where this drink had reduced me, to no hope. To no future, just indifference and angry at everybody. I had been to the Johns Hopkins, I had been to the Sunnybrook and Don Woods and Home Woods. I'd been all to all the woods and all the brooks. And and there I was without hope. And my late brother Gordon was in Cleveland, in AA, and I didn't talk to him very much because, you know, he was one of those weak alcoholics, and I didn't want to be hanging around with people like that. But I called him and I said, Gord, I need help. And the magic of this program shortly thereafter started for me. Until that time, I was not trustworthy. I didn't trust me, let alone anybody else. I could not be relied upon to show up. I knew there probably was a God, but he was so upset with me, he didn't need me anymore. And I didn't need him, I thought, or her, or it. And so I didn't pray. I didn't go to church. If I ever went to church to a funeral or a wedding, I didn't even have a twinge of conscience. And I was usually late anyway, so as I said, I was not trustworthy. And then somehow or other the magic of this place started for me. And I don't know why that happened. Yeah, I did call. And I guess I did ask for help. But there was no flashing lights or burning bush. I just was given the gift of being able to go to a meeting and put up with you stupid people and come back the next night and the next night and the next night and wonder when you would ever get it right. But I was given the gift of coming. And so my resistance and arrogance and lack of tolerance got worn down. And it was not through any exercise of my wonderful willpower, which I have demonstrated to you and you have not yet applauded or... And so it started. And I then had to learn to trust this program and to trust the power that operates through it, to trust God, to find God as part of my real life, actual life. I remember standing in a courtroom between the parents of a young man who'd been in a death through a death when he was in a blackout. And I wanted to leave. I'd had enough, and I tried to leave. And it was just as if I'd been pushed on the shoulder, turned around and sent back in and put back to this place. So God has a will for me. God has a will for you. I had to discover, what is that will? What is God's will for me? And I thought it was something ethereal or something limiting or something too difficult for a guy like me. In fact, I know it's a little indelicate, but I really did think that if I were to do God's will, I would be sent to some third world African country into some missionary kind of work into the bush and never get laid again. Now, under the circumstances, who would want to do God's will? But you guys taught me. You guys taught me to trust this power absolutely. Bring it into my life. Trust this power absolutely. Do the next correct, good, positive, right thing in front of me to do, instant by instant by instant. And I would be okay. And that would be God's will for me. So, for your benefit, I will now do God's will, which the next correct, positive thing for me to do at this instant is to sit down and shut up. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I remember coming out of a binge, and the wife had left the house and taken the children, and I'm reading the LA Times Sunday, which is a thick newspaper, and I'm reading everything just to not get up and do what I didn't want to do. And at the very back, there's a little 3-inch column that said, "The Veterans Administration has determined that the average male alcoholic is married, has a home, has a job, has a car, has children, and regularly goes to church and is 35 years old. Well, I had a car, I had a wife, I had children, I had a job, and I regularly went to church, but I was only 30 years old. Honest to God, I felt relieved. Thank you. I remember another time. My bartender's name was Joe, and I represented a lot of bars back then. and it was just a beer joint. But he had that Johnny Walker Red for me. And so I'd have Johnny Walker Red with a beer chaser. And I had been there closing the bar the night before, and I was there early in the morning. And I'm sitting, and I looked at him, and I says, "Joe, I think I'm an alcoholic." And Joe tossed down his bourbon and had a swig of his beer. And he says, "Hell, Eli, you're no alcoholic. You don't drink any more than I do." And that gave me some license for some more. Bernie from, I was going to say PSI, pounds per square inch, until I know it's PEI, okay? Our friend Bernie from PEI.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Bernard, and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was, and I sure did not want to be one. If I wanted not to be anything in my lifetime, I wanted not to be alcoholic. And really, over the last few years, as I have observed my own alcoholism, I still had the same feeling. I did not want to be alcoholic. And thank God, by His help and the help of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to be sober today. And I hope I always have that want. I am delighted to be here with my learned friends, even if some of them are from another foreign jurisdiction. And I'm extraordinarily delighted, and I ask you to pay close attention to this, for if you notice closely, they dressed to hear me talk. Aren't they wonderful? I started drinking at a very young age, I think. I thought I was young. I was 16. I was with a group of older people and older men. We went to a country dance, and they went in town and bought some moonshine. And before they drank it at the dance, they decided they'd test it. So they poured it out on the floor of the car. And it dates me. There's rubber mats then. They lit it with a match. And it come up in the form of a flaming cross. And they were absolutely terrified. Another chap and I had a different point of view. We suggested that maybe it was blessed. And we, of course, drank it. And I will never forget that feeling. It made me conclude that the only reason why people did not drink was because they did not know how good it could make them feel. And I actually felt sorry for them. And I proceeded on that path for the next few years with a lot of external control. I attended a university where there were a lot of rules and regulations, and I was in the Canadian Navy, and I frowned on daily drinking, and I drank at every occasion that I could. And one particular thing I noticed about my drinking was that one drink, I would say, "No, I don't want one drink." Now, if I ever thought there was only one drink and you offered it to me, you could keep it. I didn't want it. And if you had several around, I'd join you. And I don't know how come I was like that, because I grew up in a family where my mother didn't drink, and my father was like John C.'s father. I don't think he ever finished a drink in any given day. So I do not understand why I would have to have several drinks or none at all. I still don't understand that. Maybe some of you can enlighten me after. I know I had a doctor that told me, he gave me an answer that helped me. He said, "You're like that, Bernard, because maybe you're alcoholic." I thanked him very much. And I went from pillar to post. I started practicing law. I woke up one day and said, I'm drinking too much, I better get married. So I got married. Settled right down to a good drunk. And stayed that way for several years. Had three beautiful children. And one day I'm alone with the three children. My wife, our ex-wife, could not stand that place that I was calling home anymore. And I went through a rather trying period of time, having custody of three small children. And being a single parent is as tough a job as anything I know of. And, of course, I was going through a fair amount of litigation. And I could not make a sane or clear decision. And one day, I was visiting my mother. And she said to me, and this is in February, my Bernard, you have a nice tan. And the furthest south I had been was to Augustine Cove in the southern, off Northumberland Strait in Prince Edward Island, totally covered with ice. And then I saw a little tear. And I was hurt. And a few weeks later, I'm walking down the street one morning and I run into the chief of police in Summerside. He looked at me and he said, Bernard. And he knew my circumstances. He said, Bernard, if you keep drinking, you're not going to make it. I didn't think that was a very nice morning greeting, but I remembered it. And after that, a couple of weeks after that, I went to visit my father in the home for the aged. And I had been at the officers' club for a couple of hours. And by the time I got out of there, I was Admiral of the Fleet. And you just should have seen the look of that old man. His shoes were on the wrong feet. His shirt was buttoned crooked. Everything was disheveled. He was a total mess. And I scolded him about turning out so messy and straightened out his feet and his shirt and so on. And then he started talking. And he said these words. And I must tell you this, the other members of my family did not visit him very often. I had four sisters and my mother. They couldn't tolerate it. And he didn't know them at all, according to them. But he looked at me that day and he said, you have everything I ever wanted. I used to lie in bed at night and cry because I couldn't get an education. But yes, you have everything I ever wanted. And now I thank my God I'm not like you. That did bring about a bit of rage in me, but the message stayed. And a few weeks later, I'm in my office. I have this client there. And we're waiting for something. And I tell him how I'm feeling. It's on a Monday morning. I tell him that I'm sleeping in fits and starts. I wake up, sometimes I'm sweating. I wake up another time and I'm freezing. I'm shaking inside and out from the bottom of my feet to the top of my head. My God, how come I'm the only one that has this flu? I was the doctor. And this gentleman replied, Bernard, I think you're having withdrawal from alcohol. And I nearly died. I knew he knew. And then, of course, this is my office that this character is making this speech in. And I say to him, and who do you think you are to make a statement like that to me in my office? And he replied, Bernard, I'm alcoholic, and he hung his head. And he stayed with me for the next 3 days, like that stuff does to a baby's diaper. I could not get rid of him. And he took me to see a doctor who specialized in treating alcoholics. And I can remember yet driving in, and this was down in Charlottetown, 50 miles from where I was living. And I was so embarrassed and scared, I got down on the floor of the car and hid under the dash. I didn't want anybody seeing me going in to see that doctor who treated drugs. And he took me in the back door, and I got in a room, and I knew a half a dozen people there. And they were very glad to see me. And then the doctor started asking me questions. And I'm trying to tell you all of this to show an example of miracles in my life. I don't know why these things happened. But the doctor said to me, he asked me a question. Bernard, did you ever go on the wagon? My God, I love that question. And I gave him a 5-minute speech about going on the wagon and how good I was at doing it. And then he replied, Bernard, it's been my experience that social drinkers don't go on the wagon, they drink whenever they want to. So I knew he had my number. And I'm in a jam. And I say to him, you must be surprised to see me. You saw a little while ago how I tried to get out of a jam with my dress. I was happy to never leave us. And from there, I lost my train of thought. Oh, yes, I asked him, you must be surprised to see me. And he replied, not really. You've been on my list. I lived 50 to 60 miles from where that guy was working. So it must give some indication of what I was doing. And I was sent to Chit Chat Farms in Reading, Pennsylvania. But here's where the miracle happened. And I think it happened right then. I decided somehow I was given the grace or the power to decide that I would do what I was told to do. And that Bernard would no longer do the telling on a daily basis. And I had a most glorious experience. But it was most difficult. For when I left, I was sure I would lose custody of the children and my life would maybe be quite a mess from then on, but I just had to go. The power was there to send me, and I went, and I am able to tell you today that since August the 10th, 1981, I have not had to have a drink of alcohol. And I thank my higher power for that. And absolutely wonderful things have happened in my life. And it happened in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to get remarried. My wife and I have 5 children. And the children have all gone on and grown up. And every one of them has at least a ticket to do something worthwhile. And they're all trying. And they are very, very proud of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had 4 children, 4 or 5 teenagers at the same time, and I needed a car to get to a meeting on a Saturday night. We lived out in the country. And it annoys me even to this day that none of them ever complained about me taking the car to go to my Saturday night meeting. And I'm sitting on my famous little boat that my friend Scotty from Saskatchewan laughs about. He says, I love the power of command. He's right. He's lucky I didn't throw him overboard. We sailed from the long sail from Charlottetown to Summerside, and but this particular day, I'm sitting on the boat, and I pick up this book, and I flip it open, and it opens at a chapter that tells my story. And the annoying part of that is that I think it may have been written before I was born. But I'd like to share with you a little bit of what this book said about me that I've tried to tell you. Now and then, a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such Sally. We know our friend is like a little boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take 6 drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness, such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. We have shown how we get out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing. But am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum, like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor. But how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? What a wonderful question. How often I ask that question myself. Is there another way? I had become an absolute nothing. I couldn't stand Bernard. Bernard was completely destroyed. Bernard, who should be a good, well-educated, nurturing person who loved his fellow man. And Bernard had become a nothing. And I love that question. Have you a sufficient substitute? And I will forever love the answer. Yes, there is a substitute. And it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked up the word fellowship in four different dictionaries, and they had a common definition. A group of people, like you, banded together to solve a common problem. And if you ask me why four dictionaries, my answer is, half measures avail us nothing. And listen to these promises. They hit me right between the eye. This book is full of promises. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. And here comes the greatest temporal promise I've ever seen written for anybody on the face of the earth. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship. And so will you. I told you that I ended up with a rather wonderful life. I think I have, anyway, and that's the important part of it. As people look at me, I'm sure they would think I have anything any man would want. And this is kind of a very special occasion for me. For yesterday was the last official day I was able to practice law. I had 40 years and 5 months as a member of the bar, a practicing member, and that has been terminated. So this is a great way to start the new career. And somebody asked me what I was going to do, and I replied, I said, I'm really going to work at trying to live one day at a time. I hope that's not too heavy, but that's what I plan on doing. And as I said, we have been blessed with a great family life and all the kind things that can happen. And I always was struggling with a wish, my greatest wish. And my greatest wish was to die sober. But I didn't like it because there seemed to me to be some wiggle room. I said, sweet God, I can get drunk before I die. And my wish for us is this. I wish that we live sober one day at a time until we die. Bless you and thank you.